ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. And this week, Casey Kilmar joins me to kick off my year-long centennial celebration. We start the month by honoring composer Leonard Bernstein, beginning with one of his most well-known musical efforts, 1961's West Side Story. Leonard Bernstein was originally born Louis Bernstein to Ukrainian Jewish parents on August 25, 1918. Born and raised in Massachusetts, at 15, Louis Bernstein legally became Leonard, though he'd always be referred to by friends as Lenny. His parents were initially resistant to his interest in music, but the young Bernstein eventually transitioned to Harvard in 1935 to study it. After completing his work, Bernstein moved to Greenwich Village, where he shared an apartment with a motley trio that included Adolph Green and Betty Comden, the composers of The Bandwagon, and actress Judy Holliday. Bernstein worked his way up the musical ladder, eventually getting the opportunity to conduct the New York Philharmonic Orchestra after the original conductor, Bruno Walter, came down with flu. We'll never know how Walter felt about the whole thing, but it garnered Bernstein the chance to go through a series of guest conducting gigs, before ultimately becoming the music director of the New York City Symphony.
New York, New York, a wonderful town. The Bronx is up and the battery down. The people ride in a hole in the ground. New York, New York, it's a wonderful town.
As Bernstein made his way as a conductor, he was also composing original material. In April of 1944, he scored a ballet entitled Fancy Free, with the dances choreographed by Jerome Robbins. You might know Fancy Free for its later filmed iteration that actually only includes one of Bernstein's original songs, which you just heard, On the Town. But it wasn't until the late 50s that Bernstein struck musical gold, with a Romeo and Juliet story set on the Upper West Side. West Side Story originated in 1947, when Jerome Robbins came to Bernstein and writer Arthur Laurents about contemporizing Romeo and Juliet. He envisioned it as a story about a Jewish girl and a Catholic boy in opposite gangs dealing with anti-Semitism. Originally titled East Side Story, Bernstein wanted it to be an opera, but the idea was quickly nixed. So was the plot, which seemed to share a bit too many commonalities to another musical that was on the stage at the time, AB's Irish Rose. But the three men couldn't seem to crack the story and ended up shelving the idea for 5 long years. When Laurents met up with Bernstein a few years later, the two gravitated toward recent news reports about teenage street gangs and discovered that they'd cracked the secret of East Side Story. After changing the gangs to Puerto Rican immigrants versus Americans, Laurents, Bernstein, and Robbins came together to work on it. The finished product didn't hew completely to Romeo and Juliet, but it was close enough. West Side Story made its debut on Broadway in 1957 at the Winter Garden Theater, where it was a commercial and critical success. Hollywood soon came calling to translate the film to the stage, one of many musicals translated from Broadway shows in the 60s, and they brought in Robert Wise to direct. Wise was an interesting choice since he was more commonly associated with gritty New York dramas, and Wise knew he was out of his depth, so he agreed to let Jerome Robbins direct the musical numbers in the film. Unfortunately, Robbins was unable to cope with the stress of filmmaking. With just a third of the movie done, the budget skyrocketing, and Robbins on the verge of a nervous breakdown, he was forced off production. Wise, though, knowing how much Robbins contributed, asked that he be retained as co-director, which is why both of them won when the movie eventually won Best Director. Almost none of the original stage cast was retained or even considered for the film. Many of the actors were already in their early 30s and were considered too old to play believable teenagers. If only they knew that by 1978, 30 was just the start of how old you could be to play a high schooler. Guess they figured early to mid-20s worked just fine then. After auditioning everyone from Elvis and Bobby Darin to Audrey Hepburn and Valerie Harper, the cast of up-and-comers, with the exception of established actress Natalie Wood, was assembled.
I feel pretty, oh so pretty. I feel pretty and witty and gay. And I pity any girl who's in me today. I feel charming, oh so charming. It's alarming how charming I feel. And so pretty that I hardly can believe I'm real. See the pretty girl in that mirror there. Who can that attractive girl be? Such a pretty face, such a pretty dress, such a pretty smile, such a pretty me.
Upon release in 1961, West Side Story, the film, was a critical and commercial success just like its stage predecessor. The film garnered a $2.5 million profit for Studio United Artists alone, and walked away with 10 Academy Awards, a record for a musical that's been unsurpassed to this day. Leonard Bernstein remains one of the most famous figures in 20th century composing, whose music infused the likes of jazz, Jewish music, and theater sounds. Unlike other music makers, Bernstein never became fully immersed in Hollywood, and was always frustrated that his compositions were not as well regarded by critics as he'd have liked. He only composed original music for a film one time, in 1954's On the Waterfront, and would devote most of his life to music for the stage. Bernstein passed away in 1990 at 72 years old. When we come back, Casey Kilmar joins me to join the Jets and Sharks in West Side Story. Okay,
buying on credit is so nice.
One look at us and they charge twice.
I'll have my own washing machine.
What will you have, though, to keep clean?
Skyscrapers bloom in America. Cadillacs zoom in America. Industry boom in America.
12 in a room in America.
This week, as we honor centennial celebrant composer Leonard Bernstein, we are talking about the 1961 musical West Side Story, an episode long in the making, one of my favorite musicals, for better or worse. But I am here today with the amazing Casey Kilmar, who's going to be my guest talking about song, dance, Jets, and Sharks. Casey, how are you?
I'm doing just fine. How are you?
I am great. Casey, you probably won't remember because the episode never happened, was one of the first guests I ever had on the podcast. Unfortunately, that episode did not turn out, so we never put it out. So technically, Casey is returning. This is the first time you're hearing her. But Casey, for people who don't know you, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and feel free to promote whatever you want to promote.
I mean, I was doing a lot of classic film stuff. I go to TCM Film Festival just about every year if possible. I have a blog that I don't really use, to be perfectly honest. I've been kind of in the music scene recently, so I've been concentrating on that a little bit more, which, shameless plug, Casey Kilmar Music, find me on Facebook.
The one year that we were social producers at TCM, she actually came up with a really great idea to combine music and classic film.
The idea was I was going to bring my guitar with me, and we were gonna do like a sing-along type deal while people were waiting in line to go into the movies with music from the movies. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. Copyright laws and such.
Stupid copyrights.
Yeah, I know, right?
It's great that we have you on because we're talking about a musical today. Perfect blend. West Side Story, I remember seeing for the first time in choir. I did choir 2 years in a row. I don't know why. I think it was the only elective that they could put me in because I didn't take PE. And I loved it. Everybody else in the class was bored as hell by it, but I loved it so much. It's one of my shameless loves because I know it's probably one of the more dated musicals that everybody can make fun of. probably mostly because of its flaws more than anything else. But Casey, what's your background with this movie?
My mom showed it to me years ago. I honestly don't remember the first time I watched it. I might have been a teenager. I saw it for the first time. I really liked it. I was probably very confused as to what was going on. I didn't fully understand it. As I was older, though, probably, 4 years ago, I actually got to see it performed on stage, and I understood a lot more and was actually taken back by a lot of the scenes that they do. They're very out there with sexual content in some of them. And the stage production is, it's not a ton different, but...
It's definitely more adult than the movie.
Very much so. Yes, very much so.
That's a great introduction to the first talking point, which is that this movie is based on a stage play. Probably one of the more changed of stage transitions. Leonard Bernstein is probably most famous for composing two musicals of his transition to film, this and On the Town. I watched the stage play. I went and saw it maybe about 7 or 8 years ago, and I didn't like the play because I think I had seen the movie so many times, because the play itself, it's the same story, but it's more overt in what it's trying to say about teenagers versus the authority. I think it was Andrew Lloyd Webber wanted this to be one of the first musicals that had cursing in it. When you're listening to, like, the Officer Krupke song, it's not supposed to be Krupp you. I mean, it's supposed to be the F word. A lot of the lyrics, mostly in America, were changed for film. And they also move things around. They move I Feel Pretty and Officer Krupke after the intermission in the play, whereas in the movie, the Officer Krupke song is before the intermission. I Feel Pretty is the first song after the intermission. I like the setup of the movie, I think, better than I like the setup of the play. What do you think?
I would have to agree. I like the movie better. It's the same situation with you, where I feel like a lot of the time you are going to like the thing that you see first more. That's been how it has been with me with several things. If you see a remake first, before the original movie, typically, not always, but typically you're going to like the remake better as opposed to the original, just because that's what you were introduced to and that's what you fell in love with. So I think that has a lot to do with it.
Some of the changes that the film makes are for the better. I haven't listened to the original incarnation of America, but from what I have read, the original Broadway version is incredibly racist.
Really? Listen to it either.
Supposedly, there's a line in the song in the movie version. It's one of the men characters tells one of the women characters that you came with your mouth open. And I think it's in the original song, it's you came with your skirt open. I don't know. It's more sexually tinged.
Oh, wow.
It's definitely more belittling to the Puerto Ricans, whereas the movie version is definitely on the nose about how the American dream plays differently to immigrants, which I think works to its advantage. I want to bring up one of the big changes that I think is hard for people who see the play first and the movie. A lot of the movie is meant to be seen from a film perspective. So I think of like how dances are constructed in this film. A lot of aerial shots. You're supposed to watch this from an angle that is meant to be filmed. So that opening scene with the Jets and the Sharks when they're fighting on the playground, and there's that weird random, it's probably my favorite scene because it's so random. They're gonna fight and then everybody stops and poses from the air. You're not gonna see that on a stage. That's a moment that is specifically meant to be filmed. And it makes no sense in film. Like, why would they stop to pose before they beat the crap out of this guy? That works to make it more distinctive, but it also makes it dated. One of many weird things I think the movie has to navigate.
I definitely agree. There were a lot of moments in this movie where I'm just confused and you have to giggle because it's so ridiculous, but it's good. It works for the movie. It's just funny to watch.
It's hard to watch movies about teenagers written by adults because it always feels like that Steve Buscemi, hello fellow kids meme, where it just feels like they're trying to tap into the zeitgeist. This came out in 61. West Side Story performed on stage in 57. And the movie was made in 61. 57 is coming at the end of this time of peace and prosperity and the baby boomers and mom, pop, and apple pie. And it's leading into the early 60s, which by the end of the decade, you're dealing with this real sharp divide between adults and children. And the movie always feels like it's trying to tell you a story about these crazy kids who have nothing to do. I mean, the movie tries to make an argument, especially in the song where they're singing about how Riff is acting out, how his parents are not around. And it's a really funny, humorous song showing the cycle of juvenile delinquency. But it comes with so many adult figures saying, why don't you crazy kids just learn to get along? That's what keeps it at a distance, even compared to something like Greece in the late 70s. You're dealing with a lot of old-looking teens, yeah. And this idea that this is kind of coming at the end of the juvenile delinquency period of films that probably best exemplified with like Marlon Brando's The Wild One. It just feels like this is the last gasp of trying to corral your crazy kids. I don't think anybody in the end of the movie looks good, adults or children. What do you think, Casey?
They're all terrible people. The adults just let it happen. And when they're carrying off Tony, the officers, he just lets them take the body. What are you doing? You just killed him. Everyone looks horrible.
It's one beat cop. I mean, it's just like one detective and one beat cop in this entire neighborhood. And they're chronically asking, like, why don't you tell us what's going on? I don't know, maybe do some detective work. It's two gangs. They probably live relatively close together. You can't figure out where a rumble's going to happen. These are the worst cops in the history of cops.
It's really, really frustrating to unfold.
Well, and this is supposed to be based on Romeo and Juliet.
And I hate Romeo and Juliet. I hate it. It hurts me so much.
They wanted to do the story, I think, about an Italian boy and a Jewish girl. By making it an American kid and a Puerto Rican girl, definitely you're able to get more of a culture clash. At the same time, it still doesn't feel equal between the two of them. The obvious thing we got to point out about this movie is brownface. So much brownface. I think the reason that this stops being a classic to a lot of people, especially people of color, is that there's only one Puerto Rican person in the entire cast, and that's Rita Moreno, who's actually Puerto Rican. Right. Everybody else is American.
Shakira's is from Cincinnati, Ohio. I'm sorry, Norwood. Close enough.
How hard is it for you to watch this movie knowing that reading something about how much they spent on makeup for this movie? And I was like, it's makeup to make everybody look brown.
Hey, guess how you save money? You hire people of that ethnicity.
And I mean, somebody's going to say, you know, oh, it's the 1960s. They weren't going to hire. Right. I mean, we know the history of film was not open to getting minorities. We're still not at the point where we always hire minorities to play minority parts. I think what keeps this movie at a distance from people enjoying it is that it's 1961 and you have Rita Moreno, who's darkened up because they needed to have her match the shade of color that Bernardo, who is George Chakaris, and Natalie Wood's Maria are. Natalie Wood's got some nice, like, highway to her. Richard Beamer looks more Puerto Rican than American.
I completely agree with that.
I mean, that's the hardest thing.
I was so confused at first. Yeah, it's ridiculous. Can we just talk about Natalie Wood's accent for
yes.
a second here?
Yes.
Oh, it's not bad. She does well with it, but it's so weird. It's Natalie Wood with a Spanish accent. What is this? What is happening? It threw me off. I tried to ignore it. Now, the first time I ever saw this movie, I didn't know who any of these people were. I was young. I hadn't got into classic films yet. I didn't know who Natalie Wood was. So it wasn't strange to me. But now I've seen her in other things. I know who she is. It's the weirdest thing. Ugh, it's horrible.
And it's hard to believe that this was made the same year she did Splendor in the Grass. Which
oh,
she's
wow,
so good in. She's so good in it, and she followed it up with a equally great musical after this, which was Gypsy. When she's introduced, it's shocking, and you're right that watching this the first time, not knowing who these people are. You're able to buy it. And watching the rest of her movies, it's hard not to see it as the most racist thing ever, because she's got this Mario-esque, Latin-tinged accent. And some of her lines are actually dubbed by Marnie Nixon, who sang for her. If you listen when she tells Tony, "I love you," in Spanish, and it sounds weird, you're thinking, okay, well, it's just Natalie Wood really bastardizing Spanish. No, it's actually not her voice. It is Marnie Nixon's voice.
What is the point of that? Why?
I have no idea. I mean, I will say that Natalie Wood's Spanish is not terrible in the few scenes that she speaks it. Mind you, it's very hard not to see her Spanish utilized in, like, the most racist ways. It's like when you watch movies and the only Spanish they know are the most obvious words, like por favor.
Words that everyone knows?
Exactly! It's when you watch a movie and they have bonjour and then they feel the need to put the subtitles to say hello at the bottom. So when she shows up at the dance, the majority of her Spanish is querida and encantada, which are like the two most obvious Spanish lines. But I think there is a por favor five in there. It's just hard not to feel like she is talking in a serape-tinged, white people Mexican type of way. She is the equivalent of the Chili's, the restaurant. You know it's supposed to be Mexican food, but it's made by white people. And I hate to ruin Natalie Wood, because I love her so much, but it's bad enough she has the accent. She's got a really great tan, and she can't dance. We knew she wasn't going to sing, and when she did Gypsy, she sang her own songs. She wanted to sing in this movie, but they didn't feel that her voice was strong enough. But she can't dance. So the majority of her dance scenes, I noticed it this time around, the majority of her quote-unquote dancing is running, graceful running on her tippy toes, or twirling. So much twirling in this movie. There is no choreography.
None for Natalie.
No. How do you feel about Natalie Wood?
I feel like she is a little bit awkward. She's beautiful, but I feel like she is kind of out of place.
She is the biggest name in the cast, which I think makes her stick out.
Right. Didn't you say this was offered to Audrey Hepburn?
This role was offered to Audrey Hepburn, and she did not want it. She ended up doing her own horrible accent in a movie musical when she did My Fair Lady in 64. Yeah. I apologize to everybody who loves My Fair Lady. I hate that movie.
I am one that likes that movie.
When I get to My Fair Lady, I will have you back so that we can argue about that, because I do not like it. But yeah, this was offered to Audrey Hepburn. A lot of these roles were offered to bigger names who did not want them.
Obvious reasons.
I almost wonder, though, if it would have been better, or it would have helped Natalie Wood to have somebody who was on equal footing as her, because she really does seem too good for this movie and both totally adrift in this movie.
I can agree with that. Like I said, she just seems misplaced.
It works better when she would do Gypsy after this, because that's a role that doesn't require choreography. It requires singing, but it's pretty simple. I mean, she's not belting. That's her sweet spot.
I really loved her in Gypsy. She's great.
Do you think Audrey Hepburn would have worked better?
No, I really don't. I can't imagine her being in this. I can't picture it. When I saw that she had been offered the role, I tried, and I was just not feeling it.
Audrey Hepburn had such a clearly defined persona. Natalie Wood, I think, works to the effect that you believe she's this young girl, but she's not a little girl. Audrey Hepburn always played this childlike, wide-eyed ingenue that didn't really know the world. And I think Natalie Wood has that right blend of, she knows things, but the men in her life won't let her experience things. And I think it's important to remember, she was 23 when she made this. She's not as old as the cast members of Grease, but it's hard to believe that her older brother is George Karin.
It's very strange. I don't know exactly how old they're supposed to be in the movie. Obviously, they're in high school, but I don't know the age difference that's supposed to be there.
In reality, I think it was maybe about 4 or 5 years. He was 27, she was 23. It's hard to watch him be like, you have to watch my sister. A lot of it is the macho posturing that you would assume is in Latin families. She's this virginal thing. Although I thought it was funny, when she's trying on the dress and she says white is for babies, and I was like, white's also for virgins. And Natalie was 23. Let's segue into the other casting, the other half of this movie, the other half of the relationship, Richard Beamer, otherwise known as Milquetoast McGee. He plays Tony, our Romeo. Robert Wise wanted Elvis. This is one of many roles that the Colonel, his manager, would not let him do. God, that must have been, like, horrible to turn down considering the success of this movie. Can you imagine a world where Elvis and Audrey Hepburn play these leads?
Oh my gosh. Oh my. I hadn't put that together until you just said it. Holy cow. Wouldn't that be something?
Even if it was Elvis and Natalie Wood, I think that would have been a more equal pairing.
I agree.
Elvis was certainly lighter looking than Richard Beamer. Wouldn't have confused him as Puerto Rican.
I've seen him pretty dark before.
That's true.
I love Elvis. And I love Audrey Hepburn. So the thought of that just kind of blew my mind.
I wish there was a bigger name, because Richard Beamer, never a big star. The only other movie I've seen him in is Bachelor Pad, which is a Frank Tashlin movie that does not have Jane Mansfield, but has Tuesday Weld in it, and it is sexist as hell.
Oh, man. And he plays, I've never seen it.
Richard Beamer usually just played, like, the boy. If you needed, like, a dumb, good-looking kid, got Richard Beamer and you were fine. And my problem is, Natalie Wood was such a big star by the 60s. You need somebody that you believe can sweep her off her feet and hold his own. I don't buy that at all here. They wanted to get Warren Beatty because him and Natalie Wood were dating at the time. They just made Splendor in the Grass. I wish that had happened.
I might be thinking of, I'm thinking of Robert Wagner.
Robert Wagner, I think, would have been okay.
Yeah, Robert Wagner and Richard Beamer look very similar.
They do.
It's kind of creepy.
Richard Beamer did not like making this movie. He said that he felt he was miscast. He did not like Natalie Wood. He said that she was not friendly when they were making it. He felt that she was not friendly because Warren Beatty had not been cast. Do you think these two have chemistry in the movie?
You know, here and there, yes, but it's not constant. I tried to look at it with those eyes. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. It's back and forth.
You're right when you say they have moments. Like when they're doing the wedding sequence with the mannequin. That's very cute. Mm-hmm. It's very chaste. So I think that that works for them. But when you're watching them look at each other across a crowded room and they're doing that weird little snap dance that they do, because again, Natalie Wood wasn't going to do much more than that. I'm not really buying that this is a guy that she's going to throw over her entire family for. George Chigaris, I can understand that. Yeah. Richard Beamer, I'm not buying at all. So when Tony dies at the end of the movie, spoiler, in case you don't know how Romeo and Juliet ends.
Yeah, right.
I don't feel bad. I feel bad that Natalie Wood feels bad. If anything, and it's been a while since we've talked about homoeroticism on this show, I think the love that's purer is Tony's love for Riff, played by Russ Tamblyn. We all agree, that's a thing, right? They're into each other. Did you notice that, or is that just me?
No, I totally did. In the beginning, when they're playing the uncle, and, you know, I was just like, you guys have a thing here.
We're told that they live together, that Riff doesn't want to live with his uncle, so he lives with Tony's family. Yet he mentions that he hasn't seen him because Tony got a job, and then they have their weird little, like, dude bro handshake. I'm thinking, yeah, that's the relationship right there. They're into each other. Poor Maria is just a beard.
Can we have a side film here? Because I can't think of the actual...
Yeah, there definitely needs to be a spinoff.
When I think of spinoff, I think of television shows. But yes, there needs to be a spinoff with Riff and Tony and their love affair.
Yes, I would be totally okay with this. I do like Russ Tamblyn. I mean, he auditioned for Tony and it came down to him and Richard Beamer. Richard Beamer got Tony and Russ Tamblyn got Riff. And I mean, Russ Tamblyn's good. He's definitely got that rappy thing going for him. We got to talk about the gangs here really briefly before we go back to cast, because how do we feel about the whole group is very gay? It's hard to ignore that. They all have weird names. They all talk. Again, this is one of those movies where it's in modern day. produced in the late 50s for the play. The movie was made in 61. They talk like they're from this like cool hip jazz era where it's like daddy-o, and it's hard right. to believe that these are teens actually talking words. A lot of prostitute jokes too in this movie. I did not realize. Everybody's talking about how Action's mom is hustling on the street, and they tell the tomboy who wants to be part of the gang she needs to go walk the street like her sister.
Walk the streets like her sister, yeah.
I was sitting there thinking, well, these guys are jerks. I don't know why this girl wants to be part of their group. I'm pretty sure they all love each other.
I'm more on the shark side, to
yes!
be perfectly frank, because the Jets are jerks, 100%. They imply it in the film when Rita Moreno goes to tell Tony that Maria is held up. They imply that they're going to rape her.
Yes.
On the stage production, they straight up do it.
Rita Moreno said she was traumatized by having to film it because she had been raped as a child.
Oh, wow.
If anybody ever reads her autobiography, yeah, she details litany of childhood abuse. Filming that scene had brought it all back. This movie is very all over the place with tone. The scene is very tense. They go in to attack her. They have her on the ground, and then they do this stupid dance move where they like grab the guy and swing him up in the air like in a trapeze, and they're gonna balletically drop him on her to assault
her.
Weird. It almost makes the scene comical when it should not be comical.
Maybe they did that to try to take some of the edge of the scene off. It still made me very tense. I was remembering seeing it on stage. It's awful. It's just sick. She's done nothing wrong, and you're just going to attack her for no apparent reason, just because you're all a bunch of, I really want to say a bad word here. Like, we'll go with jerks.
The movie wants to make this statement that both sides type of argument, that everybody's bad. The Jets hadn't been rapers, Maria and Tony would have gone off together. And if the Sharks weren't doing that, no, I firmly believe that the Jets ruined everything, because
yeah, I blame the Jets 100%.
There's no reason to assault her at all. I understand that their buddy died, but nothing the Sharks do is as bad. Accidentally killing Riff, that's an accident. And even Tony says they didn't mean to. It was heat of the moment. No, you guys with malice aforethought are going to assault this one. I'm Team Sharks all the way. Let's talk about the Sharks, because I think that a lot of the movie works better from their perspective. There's this whole concept of immigration in the 1960s, and starts out really funny with the cop trying to tell everybody that they need to get along, and Bernardo says, can you translate that to Spanish? Which I think is really funny, because
right.
it's such a true statement that we are still dealing with today. And America, I think, is a really good song, because it's bringing up all these issues about the American dream that, again, we still haven't resolved in our country since the time this came out. I like it for that. And I love George Chakaris. I love him so much. Only one of the cast who is not dubbed at any point in the movie. That's all him. Please.
Who does Rita Moreno's singing? Is she doing her own?
Rita Moreno did almost all of her songs. Marnie Nixon and one other woman did one of her songs. A Boy Like That is not Rita Moreno, because it was not in her register. It was too low. America is Rita Moreno.
America is probably my favorite song in the entire production. It's hilarious because it's so accurate. I smile and giggle every time I see it. The bantering between the men and the women is great. And the chemistry in that scene is fantastic.
There is so much chemistry between Rita Moreno and George Chakaris. I love that the movie makes no bones about the fact that these two people are having sex.
Yeah.
There are so many asides. When she's singing Tonight, she's bathed in red light, she's putting on stockings.
Yeah,
I'm gonna get
she's
that.
Getting ready. Yeah.
I was like, yes! I love all the dance scenes with the Sharks, because I like how it's all flamenco inspired. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel dated. I mean, you look at the Jets dancing, the head bobbing, and the posing with the arms outstretched, the Fosse-esque aerial shot. It's dated. It's so cheesy and dated, whereas the Shark stuff always feels fresh.
I'm not a big fan of the ballet Jets do. let's just all line up and just come out together. Let's just come out because we're running around in our little boy group.
Jerome Robbins technically co-directed this, got about three scenes in before they fired him.
Oh, okay.
It's balletic, it's athletic, the dancing is supposed to look like movement, and the movement's supposed to look like dancing. It gets a little cumbersome after a while, because a lot of this is meant to be seen on film, not on stage. Right. So, again, you get these aerial shots, these camera angles where they're posed, like Busby Berkel style. You get a lot of these low-angle shots where they're walking, and then they have to do a hop or something. Can we just walk down the street, guys? No one else sees this. I kind of want somebody to comment walking down the street. Why are those guys throwing each other up in the air? You know, what's going on over there?
I know. You just keep waiting for it. I just wish that one of the extras would have been a smart aleck and just looked at them like, what the heck are they doing? That would have been me, and I would have been fired.
But I'd have been like, so why is it that they're bobbing their heads so much? And why are they in a parking lot screaming crazy cool to each other? I don't understand. Yeah. And that's why I think the shark stuff works much better, because they only dance in either private, like the America scene is all filmed on the roof, or it looks like people actually dancing. It doesn't look like people trying to be cool. The Jets are posers. I think that's what it is.
We've all agreed and come to the conclusion that the Jets just suck.
They do. I do want to throw out, George Chikaris is my favorite. Bernardo is my favorite character. George Chikaris does not sound like that. He's also doing a Latin-y accent. It does not seem as offensive as Natalie Wood. And he is about eight shades darker. He actually is. He's debonair. He can dance really well. And then when he dies, I'm just stuck with these stupid Jet dudes.
Still have Tony.
I don't want Tony. Ew. You have met George Chikaris. Share this with everybody.
Okay. I volunteered at the Rosemary Clooney Museum in Augusta, Kentucky for a couple years, did some work around there, did tours and everything. He was in White Christmas. So he was one of the dancers. So he was in town to be the Grand Marshal for Augusta's White Christmas parade. So I met him and Lee Merriweather. They are like best buddies. They make their jewelry together and everything, and they're travel pals. He was there for that. And there was a dinner following. And this is a really fun story, and it's something that makes me smile. I think it was in 2012 that I met him. The dinner, I was standing by the front door, and you know, it's December, so it's freezing. And I was standing there inside. He comes in from doing the parade, and he looks at me and he was like, "Are you cold?" And I said, "Yeah, a little bit." They had a fireplace, and he was like, "Well, come on, come by the fire with me." Followed him across the room to the fire, and people cut me off, but he kept turning around. He's like, "Come on," you know, making sure I was still with him. So then I stood by the fire with he and Lee Merriweather just hanging out. That was probably the highlight of my evening. Besides going back to the museum afterwards and watching his scene in White Christmas with him. He said that his favorite scene of that film is the While We're Dancing with Vera Ellen and Danny Kaye. That's his favorite scene. And I mean, he's sitting there humming along, and it was very cool to watch that movie with him. Oh, I remember them, and I remember them. They were this person, and they're so nice, and he's very sweet.
This is why I continue to be jealous of Casey, because she has stories like that.
He was great.
I do want to bring up that this was still the biggest Oscar-winning musical of all time. It got 10 Oscars, beating the record holder at that time was Gigi, a movie I despise about on par with My Fair Lady. I am not a fan of Gigi.
I did not get into Gigi. I tried.
You're not a fan of a movie where the end goal is to make a young girl into a prostitute?
Really? See, I didn't know the story behind it. I really looked into it.
Well, I mean, Leslie Caron's character is being trained to be a courtesan, which is like a high-priced whore.
Okay.
Leslie's story beat this, though, as the biggest Oscar-winning musical of all time. It won 10 Academy Awards, won Best Picture George Chakaris won Best Actor in a Supporting Role. Rita Moreno won Best Actress in a Supporting Role. Best Director, Best Color Cinematography, Best Color Art Direction, Best Color Costume, Best Sound, Best Film Editing, and Best Musical Score. And it was nominated for Best Writing, but it did not win. Do we feel all of those awards were earned?
I looked up what it was up against. I've never seen any of the other movies, so I'm not really sure, to be perfectly honest. I mean, the color schemes were really well used. I feel like it deserved a lot of them. I couldn't point out which one it didn't deserve. I don't disagree with it, no.
George Chakaris is probably the most recognizable out of the supporting actors, aside from maybe like Monte Cliff for Judgment at Nuremberg. Best actress in a leading role. Natalie Wood actually was nominated, but not for this movie. She was nominated for Splendor in the Grass that year.
Oh, okay.
Rita Moreno's win, I want to say she was the first Latin American woman to win. I could be wrong about that, but I want to say that she was. A lot of the actresses that were nominated that year, none of them have the name recognition. I mean, I think most people would forget that Judy Garland is in Judgment at Nuremberg, let alone that she was nominated.
I have no idea.
It's a very small role. She looks very bad. Color, set decoration, seems like the same five movies were nominated in 61. Wasn't necessarily a great year for film. It is funny that this was up for Best Color Costume Design alongside Babes in Toyland, which is a terrible movie if anybody's ever seen it.
No, I haven't.
And Best Director, I mean, Robert Wise and Jerome Robbins won. And I think most people, if they're going to argue anybody, would say, oh, well, Fellini should have won for La Dolce Vita. And in terms of what was nominated that year, the same five movies, Judgment at Nuremberg, The Hustler, Guns of Navarone, Fanny. I can't say The West Side Story is the best movie. If you've seen Judgment at Nuremberg, it's 3 hours, but it's so good.
Goodness.
It's about the Holocaust, but it's so good. It's such an actor showcase.
That was the only movie listed that was up against West Side Story that I actually recognized. And I looked at it, the cast alone, ridiculous. There's so many big names.
Pretty much everybody jockeying for attention. I mean, it is an amazingly well-acted film, but it's very dark and pendulous. For 1961, the 60s were a very bizarre decade of film wins as the studio system comes to an end and the rise of independent studios would come up. So this is like the last gasp. You'd see a lot of the roadshow, big epic musical take precedence. But if you get the chance, Judgment at Nuremberg is fantastic. West Side Story was the second highest grossing film of the year, next to 101 Dalmatians, which I think says a lot about what people were seeing in the early 60s. I mean, we talk about television taking over, but the two highest grossing films were a Disney animated film and a musical.
A musical.
I don't know about you. It's easy to see why the studio system was just eroding.
I can definitely see why.
Briefly talk about the ending. Unlike Romeo and Juliet, only one of them dies. Maria does not die. I'm fine with killing off Richard Beamer because he's just boring. I just don't feel like his death has a lot of weight.
I have to be honest, one of my notes on this movie was Tony is a babe. He's attractive. I think it's the curly hair and his just crooked.
He's like aw shucks type of demeanor.
Yeah, he's adorable. And I just fell in love with him. And he's so tall.
So did you feel sad when he was viciously murdered?
I did. I knew it was coming, but I couldn't remember exactly how it all came together. So I was partially on the edge of my seat. I'm like, I know someone's going to die, but I can't remember who, when, or how. When Maria comes and he's out there yelling and everything, I was just like, oh God, she, no, you guys need to go hide now. Get out of the street. And then, it hurt me. It did.
But he's reunited with his lover, Riff, at the end of it.
That's true. I felt partially what you said earlier, that you felt bad for Maria. You feel bad for her because she's just crushed. That was her love. That was the love of her life. And he's just gone right in front of her, in her arms.
Poor Natalie Wood. It's interesting that Natalie Wood is cast because, and somebody can tell me if I'm wrong, up until this point, she does not play in movies where her characters die. that could be different after her time as a star had ended and her later movies. But going through her filmography right now, and based on what I've seen, I've never seen a Natalie Wood movie where she dies at the end.
Yeah, I haven't either. I haven't seen a ton of her movies, but I've never seen her die in a film.
I kept wondering how I would have felt had we killed Natalie Wood, especially knowing how she would die eventually. It worked to her benefit that we don't have to see, like, sweet Natalie Wood gunned down by violence.
Yeah. I feel like, if anything, it would have been the classic Romeo and Juliet, and she would have killed herself.
Well, I definitely don't think they were going to do that, because I'm sure, you know, advocating suicide is probably on the list of don'ts and be careful. I'm not sure if it is.
That's fair. That's
she does get a great speech where she sums everything up. The cops show up and you're just like, dude, time and place. You guys are a dime late and a dollar short.
Yeah.
Just thinking, Natalie will be fine. She's hot. She'll find a guy. Poor Rita Moreno. Like, she's never going to find anybody that's going to be like George Chikara's level, but Natalie will be good. I mean, if anything, she doesn't have to marry that dough-faced guy she was promised to.
Yeah, exactly, because he's in jail now, so...
There's definitely going to be some jail time for a lot of people at the end of this movie.
Yeah.
I feel like for both talked about this movie and did not talk about this movie, but I think that's really the type of film it is. How do you feel? It's 61 to 2018, 57 years since this movie has been out. Do you think it's one of those that holds up that people want to see? And I say this about a lot of the 60s musicals, with the exception of maybe A Sound of Music, which is a Christmas classic.
Christmas classic?
It plays on Christmas all the time. I don't know why.
There's nothing Christmas. At all.
Exactly. I don't know why. No one will explain this to me.
I don't understand. That is my favorite musical ever.
The 60s musicals are really love-hate. A, they're long. Mm-hmm. And B, they tend to deal in material that has a lot of issues now. I know a lot of people that say that they don't like this or they don't want to watch it. How do you think the movie holds up for you? And do you think it's something that is a good way to get people into class?
Honestly, it's not one of my favorites. I don't hate it, but it's not one that I will watch over and over. But I do think it is a movie that everyone should see at least once in their life. It has a lot of great qualities to it, and it is a classic. I think it will stand the test of time. Yeah, it is dated, yes, but I don't think it's going anywhere. Like I said, I think it's something that everyone should see.
Romeo and Juliet stories, by their very nature, are dated. I know a lot of people, probably younger than I am, who, I know my brother, is not real keen on the 98 version of Romeo and Juliet, the Leo version. That feels very 90s to people. As much as I enjoy it in a backhanded way, because I will make fun of it when it plays. Oh, I'll watch it. But it's hard not to make fun of things like the homoeroticism or the posing of and the dancing. I'm a fan of musicals. I'm a fan of dance. But there are moments in this movie that just drag. The second half of this movie feels interminably long. The first half, I think, moves really quickly, and then the second half just feels like a slog. And I don't know if somebody's going to say, well, if they had put those songs in the right order from the stage play, it would have worked better, maybe. I do think it's become a niche musical, though, for classic film fans. Like, you get into other movies, and then you watch West Side Story. It is hard to get around the racism, the brown face, and the El Pollo Loco type of accents. It's so well acted. Rita Moreno is so good, and Natalie Wood is so pretty, and George Chikara has great hair, and he wears purple a lot. That works for me, but it might not work for you. Like you said, it deserves the respect of being an iconic classic film, but your mileage really will vary compared to other movies, other musicals. Yeah. Let me know your thoughts on West Side Story. You can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and I'll read them on the next episode. Once again, I'd like to thank Casey Kilmar for joining me today. Casey, where can fans find and get in touch with you?
You can find me. I'm on Twitter. It's just CaseyK11. On Facebook, feel free to add me. I'm on all the TCM groups. And like I said, music page, Casey Kilmar Music.
Well, we will be happy to see you again next time when we talk about our other Leonard Bernstein composed film, which is On the Waterfront. So, Casey will be back.
That'll close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio and Player FM, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please help the podcast out by leaving a rating. If you'd like to leave a review, that's great, but the rating is a lot easier, as I've noticed. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Want to learn more about upcoming episodes or hear exclusive content before anyone else? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast. If you're interested in becoming a patron or seeing the content that's already available, you can head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Want to learn more about the stars turning 100 this year? If you're a member of TCM's exclusive fan club, TCM Backlot, you can actually read my year-long series about the stars spotlighted here, discussing films and information you won't hear on the podcast. Right now, you can read my article about Leonard Bernstein, and next month, you can read about my thoughts on Ida Lupino, actress and director. But on the next episode of Ticklish Business, Casey Kiyomara is going to be back to look at Leonard Bernstein's only original composition for film in 1954's On the Waterfront. Till next time.